In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff of Atavist. I'm here with Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer of Longform. Hello, gentlemen.
Great intro.
Yeah, awesome intro. I'm so excited to be here with you guys.
Thanks. Who do we have this week, Aaron?
Keith Gessen. Keith is the one of the founding editors of N+1. He's also written a bunch of features for The New Yorker and a lot of reviews, and he's a super nice guy, actually. I really liked hanging out with him. I'd have him back.
Which would not be hard because their office is on our floor.
That is also true. We got a sponsor this week. It's Tiny Letter, a simple but powerful way to send an email newsletter from the good people at MailChimp. Thank you, guys. Let's do it. Hello, Keith Gessen. Welcome to the Longform Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
This is a very special podcast in that it's the first podcast that's happened entirely on the floor where our office is. Keith works at N+1, who are our floor mates here on Dumbo, Brooklyn.
Yeah, I just had to walk down the hall. I got lost.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a maze.
Well, the numbers aren't, they're not linear in sequence, the numbers on this floor.
That's right.
When did you guys move in here?
We moved in here 2008, so 5 years ago almost.
5 years ago. What was the climate in the building like when you first arrived?
When this floor was just, there was nothing. There were no walls. It was just one big open space. And Jacob, the landlord, he kind of walked us around the space a bit. And he was like, how about this corner? And we were like, okay, that's a good corner. And then he literally just paced off with his feet. He just measured it off with his feet. And he said, oh, that's, 700 square feet. That'll be $1,800. That's how we got the space.
So a lot of times when I have someone on the podcast, I like literally know nothing about them. Like, there are certain people who are writing out there who you couldn't find a single scrap of biographical information about them on the internet. And you're someone who we have an intern who like gives me like a dossier on people before they come in. We've got a lot of information about you.
Great.
There's a lot of information available about you online, but mostly not from, not in a gossipy way. You've written about your own life and you've written about the life of being a writer. I know that you, moved to New York City when you graduated from Harvard and were living with a wife at the time and, ended up moving to Boston. I know a fair amount sort of about your story. I don't necessarily want to drag you through your entire early 20s chronologically, but what were you thinking when you arrived as a 22-year-old? What dreams did you bring to New York City?
Oh, I did go to Harvard. I managed to go there and not really learn anything about becoming a professional, anything, including how to become a professional writer.
Yeah.
It was kind of amazing in retrospect, but because you can go through Harvard and really kind of emerge on the other side with a job at the New York Times or a job at the New Yorker, mm-hmm. As an assistant or a fact-checking job at the New Yorker. People do that, and I managed not to do that.
Was this like a bongs and hacky sack kind of thing, or like what else were you up to?
I played football for a couple of years, so I was playing a lot of football.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the sport.
Yeah, and that was a bit more of my social circle.
Yeah,
at school, and also I had a lot of I guess it was my feeling that a real writer does not actually hang out with other writers.
So at that point, you wanted to be a real writer.
Yeah. 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 Yes.
What, like, what was your model of like a real writer at like 21?
You know, Hemingway and Faulkner. That was, so, you know, and those guys, well, you know, now I know that Hemingway hung out with all sorts of writers.
Yeah. Right?
But at the time I thought of Hemingway as a guy who, you know, went to the woods and hunted and then went off to the war.
Occasionally right? punched someone.
And occasionally punched.
But not.
Or was punched.
Only non-writers.
Right.
So you arrived in New York, and you've documented pretty extensively in this essay. For people who are listening, there's an essay called Money that was published in N+1 in, I believe, 2006, 2007,
mm-hmm.
About sort of, it's really like a resume, in a way, with salary attached to, of the writing jobs that you held and survived on through your 20s. You reviewed extensively.
Mm-hmm.
What, how did, like, as a as someone who hadn't really considered the possibilities of actually becoming a writer and trying to earn a living, what were those first few reviews like?
Oh, okay. I mean, to go back a bit. So, you know, I moved to New York. I didn't know how one went about being a writer, and I just basically, I was like, well, if I keep my expenses down, that will be my best shot at it. And a friend of mine, who's still a good friend, Matvey Yankelevich, who runs Ugly Duckling Press. He's a poet, yep, and a publisher. And he was just leaving his apartment in Queens. So we took over his apartment at a nice, I think the rent was $714 for a one-bedroom apartment. So, and I got a temp job at Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter. Mm-hmm. I was doing PowerPoint slides. So I think the temp agency gave me a class for a week that taught me PowerPoint. So I would go in there 2 days a week. And that was enough to pay our rent. Going in there 2 days a week was basically enough to pay our rent and have food. And we had a very tight budget of like $100 a week. And then I was writing short stories, and I spent the whole year writing short stories, and I would kind of send them out. I sent one to The Baffler.
Oh yeah.
It was in 1998, and I still haven't heard back. But
you still got time.
I got time. Yeah, I'm optimistic. and then I started reviewing. Actually, after a year of this, We moved up to Boston. And I got a job as an usher at the Kendall Cinema in Cambridge. So that was not a very well-paying job. And I started reviewing for a place called Feed, which was part of the first dot-com boom. And it's amazing to think of now. This was a place that paid 50 cents a word.
All of our listeners are going to want a time machine back to this.
Yes. 50 cents a word. And you could, you know, you could go on.
And this
is
$19.99. Dollars.
$19.99. That's right. That's right.
This is when a Coke was 50 cents.
When an apartment was, you know, $800.
Yeah.
So that's like twice as, that's like a dollar a word now. I mean, literally, right?
Well, in New York, I mean, you know, there's all these things. Well, you've written about education, which is probably inflated the most, but New York itself is just has this unbelievable growing, but in every way, it's in real estate, it's in the cost of everything. I mean, we're actually growing faster than the rest of the country. We're economically breaking off the rest of the country in terms of cost of living.
And meanwhile, I mean, I was looking at, you know, a place that I wrote for a bit, about 10 years ago, was Slate.
Yeah.
Which used to pay reasonable fees, and I think now pays less. The Times pays less. I mean, it's scary to think. I mean, there's wage deflation.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the writing business. Yeah. So
so you you uh you were working as an usher at a theater in Queens, and you were doing reviews. Mm-hmm. At what point did you start feeling like I'm a real writer? Like I'm really doing it here. Like when did you turn the corner to the point where you felt like this was really a profession?
I guess when I felt like, in a way, pretty early on, because I started writing for Feed, and I quit my job as an usher. Yep. Because I was basically able to pay our rent by writing these pieces for Feed. And again, you know, our expenses were super low. I made $25,000 that year writing for Feed, and that was enough.
Good times.
Yeah.
You've written pretty extensively about the book industry, actually, as a capitalistic force, and the economics of being a writer. What draws that to you as subject matter?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, one is that writing is one of these things that is sort of mystified, right? Yeah. By our system, where you are supposed to think of the writer as existing in some kind of space that's outside of the market or outside of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And being inspired.
Yes.
Whereas in fact, you know, these are people who are subject to the very same forces as everyone else. So that's one. The other thing is, I'm very interested in these questions of who has money, who doesn't, why this is, who set this up this way. And it just so happens to be that the writing business is the one that I know the most about. It's not that I think writers are more interesting than other people. I don't. But as a case study,
yeah,
it happens
sure.
to be the one that I have a lot of information about.
When you've reported in Russia, you were born in Russia, yes?
Yes.
Yes. What is your reporter persona going to Russia and writing stories? Are you, do you see yourself as an alien, a native? What kind of an attitude do you bring when you're working in Russia?
Oh, I feel myself very much a native. I mean, I become native very quickly. I have a lot of family in Moscow, so I have two grandmothers and a sister and aunts and uncles. So, you know, when I'm writing about Russia, I'm writing about things that affect my family.
Right.
I have more family in Russia than I do in America. So I don't think of myself as a foreigner. I do think that, you know, the people that I'm interacting with think of me as a foreigner.
Right.
So they just, you know, for various reasons, and in a way that gives me a bit of an advantage, because they think I'm dumber than I am.
Does the fact that you're writing, say, for the New Yorker or an American magazine, make it more okay to talk to you because it's not being published within the Russian press?
Yeah. That's right. They don't really know what the New Yorker is, and a lot of them end up not reading the stuff. So in a way, I have a kind of freer hand.
Yeah.
I've had a few, you know, the few situations where I've had reactions to my stuff in Russia have been really unpleasant.
Really?
Profoundly. I mean, after I published an article in the New Yorker about the fact that the city of Moscow could not solve its traffic crisis, there was actually a kind of amazing attack on me in the newspaper put out by the mayor's office. And it was, you know, it said things like, even Gessen's colleagues don't understand why he hates Russia so much. And it was clear that they had not talked to any of my colleagues. It was just something that...
There's a Chad Harbaugh quote there.
Yes. Keith really hates Russia.
He talks about it in the office all the time.
It was amazing. And then you know, and they were like, well, what would the U.S. think of a Russian journalist who came over to New York, you know, and criticized their mayor? You know, what would they think of that? They would probably deny him a visa next time he applied for a visa.
Yeah.
And of course the answer is, you know, an America, the Bloomberg administration probably not read something that was written in the Russian press. but there was a kind of veiled threat that I would not get a visa, which I thought was, which was kind of upsetting.
So you're not like a, you're not a citizen.
No, I got to go get a visa every time. Yeah.
So if you were to piss off the regime enough, regime is probably unfair, or not, you could be barred from writing in Russia.
Yeah, and that does happen to journalists. I mean, it's kind of the worst thing that can happen to a foreign journalist is you don't have a lot of foreign journalists getting beaten up, although it does happen. But you do have once in a while they do get kicked out of Russia. I had a situation where I was briefly arrested, and they were like, "Well, you might get deported," and I was like, "Well." Boo-hoo. Yeah.
You know, I mean, who's paying for that flight?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, when you're in Russia, you're like, oh, they're going to kick me out of this very unpleasant, violent country. I'll probably get over it. But actually, it would be a real bummer if I couldn't ever go there and visit my grandmother's, for example.
Sure.
So,
Well, it would also be, unfortunate as a writer. I mean, I feel like, writing about Russia is it's a unique project for you that you do have certain advantages in, you have a certain history that you're able to bring to it, and there aren't 500 Americans who can write well about Russia simply because of their backgrounds. There is sort of a limited pool, and that it wouldn't be hard. Russia could cut off most of the high quality journalism about it that's published in America by just banning like a half dozen people. So
it's they might like to do that.
That might be on the agenda.
I didn't start out thinking I was going to be a writer who wrote about Russia a lot. And in a way, when I was really young, I kind of fled that subject. I really wanted to be an American writer.
Did you grow up in a Russian American culture, or were you?
I grew up in a place called Newton outside of Boston, and all my parents' friends were Russians. My parents didn't have any American friends, and so I was, a lot of my friends growing up were the children of Russians. So I had a lot of Russian friends growing up.
But that was not sort of something you wanted to pursue as a writer. Was this sort of a Russian Americanness?
Right. It wasn't, it was sort of in my 20s as I kind of started, getting on my feet as a writer, and I was writing about both things, and I still write about America also, but I just found that I could get really interested, and remain interested thinking about this Russian stuff, and that it was something that I knew about that other people didn't know about. And I just, I found it very satisfying.
Yeah.
And I still do. And I anticipate a moment where I will stop, but.
Well, it sort of draws a thread to some of the conversation we were having about nonfiction and fiction, which is, if I were to distill your ideas about fiction, there is some you write about things you know about, write about the world that you're from. And that is a unique part of your world, is having access to Russia and having, that is unique in its own way. Let's sort of zoom ahead here if we can. A lot of people who are listening probably know you primarily as one of the founders of N+1, which, as previously discussed, has an office on this floor. N+1 is founded in what year?
2004.
On kind of a shoestring, basically four guys throwing in a couple grand a piece and starting a magazine
for a total of $8,000.
So this was coming out of a period of your life where you were getting a little work writing, doing reviews and publishing occasionally. What made you say I'm going to start a magazine?
There was a bunch of us who were all publishing book reviews, basically, and that was fine, and yet we felt we could do more.
Yes.
And there was, we were, especially when you're doing book reviews, it's like you're either doing one, you're kind of, either writing very literary stuff or you're writing political stuff, or maybe you're writing literary stuff for political publication. I think a lot of us were in the position of writing book reviews for The Nation, for Dissent. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of like the literary guys at The Nation or Dissent, these political magazines.
Yeah.
And the stuff that we really liked to read was stuff that combined these things. So that was both political and literary. And so we just thought there was more ambitious writing that we wanted to do.
Yeah.
And we literally had the experience of writing things that weren't getting published.
What kind of stuff were you writing that didn't, what was the void?
The void. I think the best example is Mark Greif was writing these pieces that were this combination of kind of philosophy and something academic, kind of literary criticism and contemporary politics. And he just was able to combine these things in ways that I thought were very interesting and I still find very interesting. And there was just no place for them. So in the first issue of N Plus One, there's an essay called Mogadishu, Baghdad, Troy, which looks at American warfare in Somalia, in the Mogadishu, and the way it's described in the book Black Hawk Down, and compares this to the way the Trojan War was described by Homer, and finds that, in fact, these things have a lot in common. The action is described in very similar ways by Mark Bowden and by Homer. But the difference is that in Homer, you have two sides, and in Black Hawk Down, you have only one side. You only see the American side, and the other side does not exist except to be slaughtered. And this is a really profound observation. Sure. And it's arrived at through these various ways, and it's written in a very exciting prose. There was no place for this.
Sure.
In 2004.
Do you think the climate has improved for a piece like that or gotten worse?
I think it's improved.
Yeah. I mean, we're going on, what, eight or nine years now?
Yeah.
I mean, it bears some mention for people who have always lived in the age of the internet that there wasn't nearly as much web publishing at that point. There wasn't actually the diversity of publications then that exists now. N Plus One, at least as I encountered it, was notable because it was a sort of an upstart new thing in a climate where there weren't a lot of new things. There was things closing, but not a lot of things opening. What was that like for you personally?
Yeah, it's a lot of places had closed. The Baffler had closed, yeah. A place called Hermonaut, which we had really read and liked a lot in the 90s, had closed. Lingua Franca had closed. And then the Partisan Review died. And the only thing that had opened was McSweeney's.
Right.
And McSweeney's was very exciting, and yet we felt like they were doing everything wrong.
Yeah.
In the way that you... something that you're very sympathetic to, but is a little bit different from what you wanted.
Yeah,
you sure feel like they're doing everything wrong. So, starting the magazine was amazing. It was, I'd spent, I guess at that point I'd been out of school for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
And that entire time I was trying to write and was basically sitting in a room. I'd gone to grad school, which, you have to socialize a bit in grad school, but not really. You're really supposed to kind of go home and write all the time. And kind of got me out of the house, starting N Plus One.
Yeah.
And it turned out there was this just, a lot of enthusiasm for it. And, at the time, I guess things have changed now and I have no idea really whether they've changed, but at the time, it felt like if you went to a party, it was like a lot of, fashion people or art people. Everybody was really a lot of good looking people.
Yeah.
And then you went to a literary party and it was always kind of stuffy and boring. And we wanted literary people to have a bit more fun. And that was something that in the first few years we were able to do.
We got a public urination ticket outside a N+1 party.
That's the sort of party that that we used to.
And I nearly went to jail for it, actually.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to hear that.
I didn't pay it, and then I got a summons. So I wanted to get, and I like just remembered the summons like the day it was happening, and I went in there, and it was like entirely me and black car drivers who had picked up like fares that had flagged them. So it was like the same plea. And then the public urination plea came up, and I tried to be like fake, like lawyerly, just like a dick. And it just like, it fell so flat. Like I've never been like as tonally off as that public urination summons. I really thought I was going to like really impress the judge and be witty. He was having none of it. Just everyone else is getting their fine reduced. Like if you show up, your fine gets cut in half, pay the full fine.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
I don't blame you personally. But you threw a good party.
We threw a good party. We tried to make sure there were at least two bathrooms. But, you know, you have 300, 400 people. You need more bathrooms than that. And some people go on the street and they get arrested.
You also, and you sort of touched on this lightly with McSweeney's, but there was also a certain climate in the air of N+1 kind of starting some literary fights, kind of calling people out and being open about talking critically, not about literary issues, but about other magazines and about writers. Was that a strategy from the beginning? Is that just who you guys are?
I think it's who we are. I mean, I think a lot of people are like that, But
I'm a coward myself, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I do think there was this idea that was current in those years that everybody should be nice to one another, mm-hmm. because this whole literature thing that we've got going, it's in decline, right? So we need to just be nice to one another and try to promote this literature thing and, you know, make sure people know that literature is good for them. And maybe they'll throw a few bucks our way. And, you know, we came kind of separate directions. I came from a kind of disputatious Russian tradition.
The yelling tradition.
Yelling at one. Yeah. 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 That was my sister had a girlfriend who was English. And she always found it very disturbing to have dinner, with the family in Moscow because there was just a lot of noise and yelling. And
yeah.
That was just, yeah. And, Marco Roth came from kind of New York Jewish disputatious tradition. And Mark came from, his tradition. So we all were, came from these traditions where arguments were a good thing. And especially arguments about literature.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you going to argue about if not about the thing that's the most important thing in the world, which is literature?
It's interesting because I met you this year. This is the first time I had met you. And I remember I followed you during those years. And I was like, wow, these guys are some fucking like aggro dudes. Like they're out there starting some fights. And then when I met you, and it's sort of the way that like, you know, when you're doing like chat with someone on the computer and someone will say something and you're kind of like, whoa, that was kind of harsh. And you're like, maybe the tone's wrong. I can't really tell. Like when I met you in person, you kind of have a sense of humor about it. But like when you read that stuff, it's kind of like, wow, this guy wants to fucking like murder the editorial staff of McSweeney's.
I didn't write that. Yeah.
But do you like, I totally understand the urge to ruffle the feathers, but was there ever any thought that that was going to sort of overshadow what the work you were producing, or is that built into the work you're producing?
To be fair to the magazine, I mean, the idea was always we would have this short stuff up front,
sure.
that was really angry and denouncing of everyone. And then we would have this longer stuff in the middle of the art of the magazine that was deeper and longer and still capable of, you know, still polemical at times, yeah. right? But less focused on, the kind of intramural intellectual arguments, right? So it was never supposed to be personal, right?
Yeah. But it is. I mean, everything's personal. Of course, personal, it is.
It's hard. I mean, you know, you want to say, look, this person's a nice person, but I think their work is shit. And not only do I think it's shit, I think it's evil, right? Yeah. But if I met the person, I'm sure nice person, you know, if they are a nice person, then, you know, I would relate to them as a nice person, right? Even as I...
It's great. It's something I like in talking to you, because like I don't write if I wrote, I'd be like, I bet that guy hates my writing.
Yeah, probably.
It's great, but it's great like going out there and not being a writer. You can just be like, yeah, he hates lots of other people's writing, but it's probably cool with me. So when you start a project like that, I mean, I'm sort of thinking about the models of publications that you talked about that were closing. Is that a forever project when you start something like that? Are you its steward into eternity? How long did you, as 30-year-old guys, starting a journal and talking a pretty big game and saying this is important, this you should subscribe, you should make this a part of your reading? How long did you expect to do it?
We thought 10 years. We thought 10 issues or 10 years, and that was the maximum.
And you're at how many issues now?
We're at 15 issues and 8 years.
8 years.
Yeah. So, and in fact, we were right. I mean, 10 years is generous.
It's a long fucking time.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
And we are the sort of founding editors are slowing down. We're not mad at anyone anymore.
Yeah.
We think everything's great.
Yeah.
I think Martin Amis has described this. He has a kind of taxonomy of book reviewers, you know, it's the angry young person and then the kind of accommodating middle-aged person. And then at the end, a burbling satisfaction with all that exists.
It's kind of like a pickup basketball game where at first you like, you know, your young guys are doing hard fouls and like getting into fist fights. And then at a certain point, you're just like happy to be there. And then you're like only playing one out of every two games. And
yeah, well, that happens to you as a writer. And yeah, you just can't be as upset about these things anymore, whether it's because you have become friends with some of these people or you're just thinking about other things. But amazingly, at N+1, we've had this younger generation kind of rise up.
That's what I was going to ask you. Do you like recruit like angry young men to take your to fill your shoes?
Well, angry young women, actually.
Yeah, I've noticed that actually over there. Yeah.
So just in the past few years, it used to be when we were starting out, young people would come to us and for whatever reason, we didn't have room for them, or we were actually too close to them in age, and they would soon leave in anger.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the pattern for the first few years. And then, you know, about a year and a half ago, it became the case that either the organization was big enough or we were kind of more absent enough or something has created space for younger editors to come in and be really angry. And you know, in the just the most recent issue, there was a denunciation of Harper's and The Atlantic Paris Review. And frankly, you know, I couldn't care less.
Well, and you must have numerous friends at every one of those publications.
Yeah, especially Harper's.
Look, if you don't have any friends at some of those places, you might at some point be pitching people at those places. I mean, it's certainly possible. I'm impressed that you're able to be such a serene old man. Like, when you see something like that, are you like, oh, hold on, guys. Like, let's not go too far here.
No, I mean, well, certainly that impulse was there, and
for people who are looking, this is the letters from the editor of the most. This is the most recent N+1 or two?
Yeah, this is issue 15. You know, we began with these denunciations of other magazines. That was in issue 1. We denounced the New Republic and McSweeney's and the Weekly Standard. That was what we began with. And then, you know, recently, you know,
was the 10-year plan mapped to get every single magazine over 10 years, three or four magazines denounced on each issue.
Well, yeah, that would have covered all of them. But yeah. But over time, we became, you know, less interested in that stuff.
How do you feel about Mad Magazine?
Great magazine. Great magazine. We did denounce. There was a moment where we denounced Hebe and, you know, we denounced the Jewish magazines.
Juicy. The other
Juicy.
One,
yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But then they all Tablet. Closed. They all closed, except Hebe. Hebe is going strong.
Yeah.
Good for them. Anyway, yeah, but so, yeah, so these younger editors have come up and they're still really angry about all this stuff, and it's just great.
Do you want to tell them or anything, or you want to just, like, let things run their course?
Oh, no, I think that's great. I would just hold on to that. Yeah. I mean, that's holy. That's the thing that makes great writing.
Yeah.
It's being angry. That's
of the founders, Ben Kunkel has come out with a couple, not one novel, and
Indecision,
and Chad Harbach did Art of Fielding, very well known novel. So people have, in certain ways, moved on to I wouldn't say bigger things, but things that they may be known for. Chad is probably known as the author of the Art of Fielding more than he's known as a founder of N+1. Is that something you want to sort of follow you forever, or do you see at some point emerging and leaving it behind?
Leaving N+1 behind.
Yeah. I mean, you've done a bunch of pretty big features for The New Yorker. You know, like when I told my mother that you were going to be on the podcast, I described a New Yorker star, and she's like, oh, yeah, that guy. I know who that guy is. And, you know, how does it feel going into our shitty office building and working with young angry people every day?
Oh, well, you know, I love N+1.
Yeah.
I think it's great. You know, I mean, the moral of the story of the young people coming up means that it can live maybe another 10 years.
Yeah. So you've reset, you've moved the chains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. First cool. down.
That's got to feel good. I mean, that's an accomplishment in sort of its own right to endure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm impressed, like, in talking with you, and sometimes I felt like guilty about this afterwards. Like, I'm a man from the internet. I come from the internet. The internet is a place of gigantic numbers. But you're producing a magazine for a passionate but limited audience. I mean, you pour your heart out for these issues that I won't ask you to cite exactly circulation numbers, but they're in the four digits, I would guess, probably.
They're in the high four digits.
Whereas when you do a piece for The New Yorker, that probably is viewed, you know, more in the 6 to 7 digits, if it's on the web, say. You know, in 2004, if I told you, hey, you're gonna get close to hitting that fifth digit, that probably would have felt pretty good, I would think, to get this kind of material out. But it is small in the context of sort of mass media and the web.
Yeah, and you know, we want it to be bigger.
Yeah,
and that's why I go in there every day, and that's what we're doing in there every day, is trying to, we want to produce the stuff, but we also want to get it out to a wide audience. And I think we could be, so we print 8,000 copies now. I'd like to print 20,000.
How do you find that those new N+1 fans, how do you find that next generation who's younger than you?
We try everything.
Yeah.
Well, not everything. I mean, you know, our resource is limited, but obviously the web is a good way to find them.
Yeah.
There's problems with finding people on the web. Sometimes they are more loyal to their aggregators than they are to their content producers.
No comment. Yeah, sure. Of course.
So, you know, that's a kind of, you want to be aggregated.
Yeah.
Right. You want the link from Longform or AL Daily.
Yeah.
But you also want to make sure people know where they get the good stuff, you know? And, so I think the internet, I think there's still some outlets for writing about literature in newspapers. The New York Times still occasionally does this. So we're always trying to get stuff in the press. We have a lot of events, so people can come to the events and learn about it. You know, you got to just keep hustling all the time.
I've seen you guys out in the back when the truck comes in unloading a new issue. And this is like it's a real sight to behold. The truck shows up with boxes of N+1 and they cart them up here and unbox them. Why continue to print N+1? In that mission that you just described, of building that base, certainly easier and more efficient and cheap to get new people online. What drives the print?
I would say three things. First of all, we used to, until just a few months ago, we used to drive to the printer and pick up the N+1. So when the truck pulled up, that was truck driven by
I only saw the very end of that interchange.
So, it's possible that we were driving the truck that pulled up and we unloaded it. And it's fun to do that. It's fun to hold the thing in your hands. Mm-hmm. Frankly, you know, we're publishing stuff that's 14,000 words long. I read a lot of stuff online, but when it gets to that length, I'm not reading it online. I'm reading it. I'm printing it out, right? So why not let us print it out for you?
Yeah.
It's still pretty cheap to print stuff. It's not expensive to print. We're not spending a ton of money on printing.
And it's not like a heavily designed magazine where you guys have layout artists or anything. It's pretty text-based.
We have a very good designer, but it's in black and white. So that keeps the price way down.
Yeah.
Cost $2 an issue basically to print it.
Yeah.
It's cheap, especially when you're in the kind of where we are in the number that we're printing. So it's not expensive. It's also the only thing that we can recoup any money on, right? So if we actually want to keep employing people and paying our writers a little bit, mm-hmm. and we're trying to pay them more, print... Still, people are willing to pay for it.
Yeah,
they are not paying us for the stuff on the web.
So you haven't seen traction in selling sort of digital access to N+1 at this point.
We are selling a growing proportion of the subscribers are digital subscribers, but still, it's pretty. You know, it's 15%.
15%.
So yeah, it's growing, but it's still not the whole thing. There's still going to be for the next, I don't know how many years, 50, 40, 30 people who prefer to read stuff on paper.
50 years?
Well, I don't know. How long am I going to be alive, right?
Yeah.
Still, you know, it's just more relaxing to sit on the couch and read something on paper. So, while for the moment, the economics of it makes sense. We're trying to get it out and we'll get it to you in any kind of channel that you prefer.
You just run it over to my house if I pay enough, just hand deliver.
Yeah. We will get it to you. Yeah.
So, probably I'm guessing that like writing for the New Yorker is more lucrative than working at N+1 also. So is this sort of like a total labor of love for you right now or?
I do love N+1. You know, writing for the New Yorker is not as lucrative as you might think. Well, it just takes a long time to write one of those pieces.
I would think so. What is, when you're doing those pieces, I assume those pieces are kind of difficult to pitch because you're kind of, you're parachuting into a zone that I'm assuming that you didn't have like extensive knowledge of Kazakhstan, say, before you reported there. Well, what's the process like pitching a piece where you're going to Kazakhstan, say?
I learned when I was a staff writer at New York Magazine that pitching stuff to editors is, in a way, it's kind of hopeless. Because as a writer, you just don't know what editors are thinking. and you'll never know what they're thinking. And so with the New Yorker, they sent me to Kazakhstan and they sent me to the Arctic.
Did you know what the story was going in, or they're just like Kazakhstan story?
Yeah, they're like, go to Kazakhstan. And, they wanted a story about the new capital of Kazakhstan, right? Yeah. With the Arctic, they wanted a story about economic change in the Arctic.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of vague, outline, and then you have to fill it in.
Yeah.
With Moscow traffic, that was a story I pitched numerous times. And they were like, this doesn't sound like a story that's going to work.
You can understand where they're coming from.
I guess. But no, I can't. And so I just did it.
Yeah. Oh, you did it.
Yeah, and I mean, I've done that a few times where I just thought, you can ask for permission all you want. You might never get permission, and if you think it's a good idea, you just do it, and then you send it to them, and sometimes it works. And
well, that's interesting. So how long did you spend on that Moscow traffic piece pro bono?
I spent about a year. I mean, I actually flew back to Moscow several times to kind of do more reporting on it.
So what happens if the New Yorker's like, we were kind of right, we're not into Moscow traffic?
Then, you know, I publish it on my blog.
That's a gamble for you. I mean, that's a year down the tubes if that were to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the only thing I did during that year.
It's a huge investment, though, personally.
I don't know. I mean, it's... Dissent used to have a nice little note for contributors, and it said, if you want to write a piece, just write it, because otherwise we're going to have this long correspondence about it, you know?
Yeah.
As an editor at N+1, sometimes it's good to have a conversation about it before, but most of the time, because certain subjects I just know we're not interested in.
Right.
You know, and I could tell you that in advance. A lot of the time, you know, it could be a subject that we're interested in, but it all depends on how you write it up.
Yeah. We never even talked about the fact that you've written a book, which, will be in the show notes. We'll put a link to it. All the Sad Young Literary Men.
Yes.
Did I get that right?
I think so.
As someone who has published now some fiction and some nonfiction, what excites you going forward?
I'd like to write some more fiction.
Yeah.
But I'd like to keep doing both those things and trying to, buy some health insurance.
Yeah, that's a good. I think we can all agree. Let's get some health insurance. It's a good note to close on.
It's a dangerous world out there.
Totally. One, you know, you're out in Russia. You really need some health insurance.
If you're on your bike in Brooklyn. Yeah, anything can happen.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Keith Gessen, for coming in. It's been a pleasure. The newest N+1 is on the newsstands. Did you say it on the newsstands? It
sure is.
Yep. What's the title? What's the theme of the most recent one?
Amnesty.
Amnesty. Pick it up. Hot off the presses, Amnesty. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thank you very much to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thanks to Keith Gessen for walking the 17 feet down the hallway to come tape this. Our editor is Lauren Kirchner. Our intern is Sarah Amandalare, who gave me invaluable notes so that I could stalk Keith Gessen's whole life. We'll be back here next week. Check us out on iTunes. Check us out on Instacast. Check us out on Stitcher.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.